Hey, welcome to episode 56 of the We All Serve podcast. We're back. I'm still on a high from last week. Still cracking up, actually, from last week's conversation. It was fun. The way you summed it up, Angel, was we laughed, we cried, we sang. God, I forgot what you said, but it was awesome.
We channeled the spirit of James Brown.
We did, the hardest
working man in religion.
Man, I mean, that guy is just a force of energy, force of life. He's incredible. It was an awesome conversation, and
It was an infectious conversation, is what it is, and it just kind of pumps you up for the whole week. And for those that want to see it, you can go on the website. You can share, you can like, you can subscribe. It's just fantastic information from the Army's senior Muslim or imam chaplain. Yeah, but that's such a small part of what he did, man.
No, 100%. I mean, the guy. I mean, the stories he told and everything. It's just incredible. So, either way, with that, I don't want to take away from our conversation today. I mean, I could reminisce all the time about last week, and I think each week we have something to reminisce about. And I know we will have a lot to talk about today's conversation. So I just want to bring it in and maximize our time together.
Let's bring in Dan.
Yeah, let's bring in former Congressman Dan Donovan. Welcome to the program, and it is an honor to have you. Angel gets mad at me if I ever do a full bio. But I'm going to, I have to share a couple of quick things about our guest that's joining us here on the screen right now. Former Congressman Dan Donovan is certainly a distinguished public servant, which, by the way, is exactly what this show is all about. Served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, the district attorney for Richmond County, New York, and the deputy bureau chief for the New York County District Attorney's Office. He's had decades of experience working with high-level government officials on the federal, state, and city level. He was on the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives, where he served as chairman of the Emergency Preparedness Response and Communications Subcommittee, and was a member of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Protection Subcommittee. He was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Committee, where he served as a member of the Middle East and North Africa Subcommittee and the Africa Global Health, Human Rights, and the International Organization Subcommittee. That's quite a mouthful. But as district attorney for Richmond County, Staten Island, New York, served as the chief law enforcement and provided over 125 prosecutors, administrative staff, and NYPD detective squads. In that role, he was responsible for the prosecution of more than 12,000 criminal cases per year. He also represented Staten Island as deputy borough president and as chief of staff of the office of Staten Island borough president. With that, I know Angel's going to get, he's going to throw something at me from a couple of states away. But lastly, Dan received his JD cum laude from Fordham University School of Law, where he was a member of the Fordham Law Review, and his bachelor's from St. John's University. Truly, truly, it's an honor to have my friend, and I'm privileged to call him that, Dan Donovan, join us here on We All Serve.
Shalom, thank you so much for that introduction. I hope we didn't bore your listeners and your viewers. Let me first tell you what an honor it is for me. I've been out of office now nearly three years. This is the first show I've done in that amount of time. That's how important your show is to me. Your friendship is to me. I am an admirer of you and the service that you've given this country and still give to this day. And I thank you for that. And I also thank you. This is the very first show I've ever been on in my entire life where I've had the most hair. So I thank you both for inviting me this evening.
I'm man crushing on you, man. You got some waves going on. It's nice, you know, a little side action. It's fantastic.
I haven't been able to give it up yet, Angel.
I wouldn't either. I wouldn't either. Mine was just too gray. It was too much.
I don't have that excuse. But no, I mean, Dan, it's awesome to have you, and we're gonna. I know our conversation now is going to cover a lot of topics. But it really is about service. You and I have had a couple of early morning conversations just talking about service. And it was in that vein that I realized, you know, no conversation would be complete without the Dan Donovan on the show. So I always defer my first question over to Angel. So Angel, take it away.
Okay, well, Dan, thanks again for being on here. And as the child of I was raised by a homicide detective. So I know. And work closely with the district attorney's office in Cobb County and in Fulton County of Atlanta. And what you guys do and keeping us safe. I mean, people always thank us, you know, for our service and stuff. And it's like, you know what? Thank you for what you guys do, because you keep people so I can have a house. I can come home. I can have a house to come home to. I don't have to worry about getting shot. There's the things that you guys do that really trickle down. And sometimes people lose perspective. And I really value what you guys did for the state of New York.
Thank you very much, Angel. Appreciate it.
What I want to just kick off with is you left the House of U.S. House of Representatives about three years ago. And I'm curious, being in the chair, if you will, how did your views change from before and after, especially as it pertains to national security? Because I know that you were in somebody's very classified briefs and probably had the bejesus scared out of you, a couple of them, and you went, that's a real thing. I'd like to know, you know, your insights on how your views have changed, if at all.
You know, national security is something that's kind of a vacuum to most Americans. They don't realize the threats against our nation, and nor should they. You know, we have people who are very talented, very experienced, making sure our nation is safe, making sure that our infrastructure is safe, our cyber system is safe. But we do. We're constantly threatened by our enemies throughout the globe. And now we found even homegrown threats that we have. And so the job is so difficult. Any position I ever left, whether it was the borough president's office, the district attorney's office, Congress, I've never criticized. I've never commented on any of my successors' accomplishments or failures, just because the job is too difficult to begin with. And I think everybody wants the same thing. No one wants an unsafe nation. We just think there's different ways to go about it. I was a proponent of spending money on our military, spending money on securing our assets overseas, securing our nation homeland here. There are colleagues of mine who thought that money would be better spent in other areas that they believed would be more productive in protecting, whether it be trying to massage, trying to do more social programs. And I listen,
hearts and minds kind of stuff.
Yes, I think so. And so, you know, listen, government's number one responsibility for its citizens is to protect them. Nothing else matters. If you're not safe, the economy doesn't matter. The job growth doesn't matter. If people aren't safe, they can't do anything. And we saw that here in New York in the 70s. We had the crime waves where, New Yorkers couldn't feel safe in their own homes. People were afraid that their cars were going to get broken into, their homes were going to get broken into. In the early 90s, before Rudy Giuliani became our mayor, you know,
we're seeing it in Chicago right now.
We're seeing it throughout the nation right now.
Yeah,
in New York as well. So with that, what happens is your citizens don't feel safe. They don't feel that their families are safe. Tourists don't feel safe to come to your cities. So it affects the economy. It affects everything. The folks who now are in charge, when I was in charge, we were criticized, and rightfully so. People didn't know. I couldn't tell people why we were doing things because we were in those top secret briefings. My first briefing, Angel, they take you down to the SCIF, the bowels of the Capitol. They take away
our sensitive compartment information facility.
You are very right. And they take away all of your electronics. And because I sat on home and we got weekly briefings, sometimes daily briefings, but there was a weekly briefing. The CIA was present. The FBI was present. Homeland Security was present. NSA was present. And each agency would take the podium and give us their briefing. My very first briefing, I was in Congress for 1 week. And an FBI agent was about to leave the podium, and she said, "Does anyone have any questions?" And I was the newbie. And I raised my hand and said, "Agent, how does that make you feel?" And she said, "Nervous, sir." And I said, "So you could imagine how it's making me feel right now." and these are daily, daily threats. We extinguish so many threats because of our intelligence, our intelligent agencies, and our friends overseas. You know, I'm a proponent. I am one of the greatest supporters of Israel. We are a safer nation because of the intelligence we get from Mossad and from Israel. And there's critics of Israel And I think unfairly so, or people who don't understand their importance to us, even if it's selfish reasons why you support them. I happen to believe in their cause and what they're doing there, and that that's their homeland. And I was a believer that Jerusalem is the capital. I believe Israel should select the capital of its nation, not anyone else. But even if you're selfishly concerned about your own safety, you should support the state of Israel because it protects our own nation. So the public doesn't know this, nor should they, because they should just trust the people. And listen, over the last decade or so, people have gotten to mistrust their government. And in some occasions, they have grounds and credible reasons for that. And I often think about the young people growing up now. This is the only governments that they've known. So they've never trusted their government. We've lived through a time where most people trusted our government. But there are great people, and we spoke earlier before we went on away, great people like Colin Powell, a great general, great Secretary of State, great national security advisor to President Reagan, who make sure that the troops underneath them, like yourselves, those folks who have served and who are serving, keep us all safe. And so getting back to your question, and my answer has been so long-winded, you probably forgot what you asked me, Angel, but—
Colorful. It was colorful.
I do think that the people who are in charge have great trust in, and we should give them the resources. Congress's role should be to give the resources to those who need them to protect us and then get out of the way.
Did you have a chance to, following up on the Colin Powell piece, and one thing that we were discussing prior to joining this is one thing that I always felt, because when I first came in the military, it's funny, in 1990. So 1991, I was in Pearl Harbor for the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th. Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, George Sr., all those guys are there. And then to follow Colin Powell and see where he went post that day and all the things he was able to accomplish, not as a military general, or not as a military leader, not as a black leader, not as a male leader, just he transcended all those labels and areas to just greatness. And just you, it was one of those guy things that you got out of the Cheney years and you said, who came out unscathed? You know, there was a movie and stuff like that. Everybody's like, Colin Powell. Like, I mean, he was just so great. Everybody knew at the very core of who that man was a good man.
He was a leader, a great American, a patriot, and it was my hope one day that he would be the president of the United States. I have never spoken to him about it, but it was my understanding that he was away from home and his family for so long. I think after being Secretary of State, he may have made a commitment to his family that was the end for him, that he would be more at home for his family for all the years that he missed. A great loss to our nation, should always be remembered as an American hero. And we are a better nation because Colin Powell served us.
100%, 100%. And I remember it was only a couple of weeks ago that we obviously commemorated the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And I was reminiscing, Angel, you and I were reminiscing about where we were. And I think about a lot of the things that led me to my service. And I know, Angel, you've got your story. I know I picked the better side on the Army, but ultimately we both picked a uniform. And and I remember seeing Colin Powell. And I will add, by the way, another hero of mine, Condoleezza Rice. And just on so many levels.
Incredible. Right now, she's still doing incredible things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just, you know, people like that inspire me to serve. So with that, I actually want to, and we're going to talk more about, you know, your time in the House and your time, you know, before the House. I in preparing for this, I listened to a couple of your former episodes that you've been on, a couple of different talk shows and things like that. And we're honored here on We All Serve that we're the first post office interview over here. But I always like to take it a couple of years back, Dan, to when you were just getting started in your career. When was it that you realized that that public service was going to be a choice for you? Because we know it's not for the faint of heart. We know it's honestly, it's no fun getting into it and the attacks and things like that. And, you know, when was that? Tell us what the Donovan household was like, and what's some of the experiences that led up to your first movement into office?
Well, you know, I grew up in a house. I was an only child. My father was a longshoreman, never graduated high school. My mom worked in a factory where they made uniforms for schools and for marching bands, things like that. And she graduated high school, but that was the extent of her education. But uncles on both sides of the family were cops and firefighters. So I was going to grow up and be one of those because my father would not let
family
me
business.
Be a longshoreman. Yeah, he would not let me be a longshoreman, although I wanted to because my dad was a longshoreman. And so for a short period of time, you know, I went into law enforcement, realized that was a limited opportunity for me, that I didn't know what I would do with a law degree, but I thought my life would be better with one than without one. So while I worked full time during the day, I went to law school at night, and it was the mid 80s, and they were paying young associates ridiculous amounts of money. And coming up from a household where we had no money, I remember getting admitted to a Catholic all-boys high school, and my mother and father didn't know how they were going to pay the $35 a month for my tuition, because our rent was only $60 a month. We never owned a car. We never owned a home. I thought my life would be different with a law degree, and again, got offered these tremendous opportunities from these big Wall Street and Park Avenue law firms, went to one of them, and after a year, realized that I would rather stick needles in my eyeballs than do that for the rest of my life. And so I had a relationship with a woman named Sally May, who held all of my student debt. Sally and I agreed that I would pay her over 20 years rather than 10 years. And I took a 70% cut in pay and went to the Manhattan DA's office as a prosecutor, and I never looked back. And from there, I went on to serve my more local community as deputy borough president of Staten Island, was elected district attorney, and then went to Congress. So 32 years of my life have been in government. This is actually my first venture into public life after Congress. And so it's been fulfilling. I remember going to my 25th law school reunion, and I was the poorest guy in the room, but I was the happiest.
And you probably had the majority of the hair.
Yeah, I did.
Fewest ulcers.
Oh, they were miserable. But all those young assistant district attorneys that I would hire over the 12 years I was the DA, and there was scores of them, I would sit there and tell them, when I was in a law firm, I loved my life once every 2 weeks, the day we got paid, and hated it the other 13 days. You come work with me, you'll love your job and your life 13 days, you'll just hate it on payday. So I said, it's a better compromise. And public service, again, I'm still probably the poorest guy in my graduating class, but I'm sure I'm still the happiest.
Well, Dan, I just want to ask one follow-up question to all of that, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I've loved Angela, and I've talked about this since, you know, I've only been in the Army for 3 years, almost exactly 3 years, and I didn't realize how much I would love my service and how much it would change me. I came in as the old guy. I was 29 years old when I came in, and I didn't think I could change. And I changed. And it's changed me in a very positive way. So what I find fascinating, and sort of as I read your bio a couple of minutes ago, in all of the different offices that you've been in, you've had the opportunity to have a direct role in influencing lives in different offices, obviously different aspects of people's lives. But your district, and please correct me if I'm wrong, including Staten Island, which is a very unique place, because it is, not to get too political over here, but you were a Republican in elected to New York City, and
which is super blue. It's like neon blue.
I was the first Republican elected district attorney in New York City since Thomas Dewey in 1937 or 1932.
Wasn't that like during the Truman years, like Dewey Truman?
Yeah, people thought he'd beat Truman for presidency, but that was the last Republican district attorney in New York City. And there hasn't been another one since I left. So we're a rarity. You know, but I attribute that to, as I always did, I ran eight times and fortunate enough was able to win six of those eight races. And I say, if I was a baseball player, I'd be in the Hall of Fame right now instead of out of office. But being that said, the voters are smarter than people, I think, give them credit for. And I think particularly in my district, and as you said, my congressional district was part of a good part of Brooklyn and all of Staten Island. They cross party lines. You know, I have people who vote for issues like public safety, people who vote on the economy. You know, I'm one for less government, not more government. I'm one for less tax. I think you spend your money better than your government spends your money. We need some of it to pay our soldiers and our seamen and our airmen and our the people who collect our garbage and put out our fires. We need some money. But I think you spend your money better and government shouldn't be telling you how to. So a lot of the people, Democrats, I'm still in a minority in my district. So a lot of Democrats had to vote for me in order for me to get elected. And I think they see across party lines and look at what the message is, what someone stands for, what someone's willing to do for them. And I think that's why I've had more success than failure at the ballot booth.
I think that to follow that up, Dan, I think that the majority of Americans are saddened by how incendiary and how polarizing people are based on their views. And if they were able to get through all that because of the last few years, if they were to get through that, they would probably be if there was like a bipartisan party where people go, yeah, we think that these guys over here are crazy. We think these guys way over here are crazy. We're kind of right in here in the middle where we like, you know, we agree with the majority of things that you say and the majority of things this guy says. What are your takes on that? And how do we get back to realizing who we really are at the very core?
Angel, it's one word, respect. We've lost respect for one another.
Love it.
We've lost respect for people who have different views than we have. People who think differently than we. We've lost respect. If we just respected one another, if in the House people cared more about accomplishing something than having their adversary fail. You know, back in 1986, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill probably disagreed about 90% of everything that had to be voted on, everything that was presented in Congress, everything that the president's agenda had going forward. But they were able to do tax reform together. And after they argued, they went back to the White House and had a scotch together. That doesn't happen any longer. There's total disrespect for people who think differently than you do. And if we just got respect back, we'd get a lot more accomplished. Right now, again, people would rather see their own constituents not get something as long as your constituents don't get something. Now, I believe in our system. Listen, the majority rules, but the majority doesn't get 100% and the minority gets zero. If the formula is that whoever's in the majority gets 70%, well, the other side gets 30% because they have people who are Americans too, who deserve to have something. And just because Congress flips on parties and next year it may flip the other way now.
Yeah.
And people forget that, you know, people in majority start to, you know, shove their elbows out a little bit and do some nudging. They forget that, you know, 2 years they could be in the minority and be at the other end of that elbow. So I think if we could get respect back, and I don't know the formula to that, but if we could get respect back, I think you'll find that people's faith in government will be restored. And we'll get a whole lot more accomplished than this stagnation that we see happening now.
I had a great leader here in Chicago. Her name is Rashada Whitehead, and she works with Grant Thornton, a consulting firm, people at a tax advisory firm. And I asked her something very similar to that, and she had the best answer I've ever heard. And she's like, it starts with asking questions. And I was like, why do you feel that way? And she goes, and when you say, you ask someone, why do they feel that way? And how long, and what was the journey to understanding things that direction? She goes, you validate their opinion.
Yeah.
You, instead of creating a polarizing and adversarial conversation, you share that they're important and your views are important, even though you may not agree with them. She goes, and it changes the narrative. It changes the dialogue. And that's how we get back to it. And I was like, I just sat there mesmerized.
Yeah. And you know what? You might learn something.
Oh, yeah.
If you listen to the other side, you might learn something. Yep. You know, we used to teach young assistant district attorneys, Know your opponent's argument so you could address it. If the first time you hear as a prosecutor what the defense is, if the first time you hear it is in the courtroom, you're going to lose. So what is my adversary's position? What are they thinking? What are their arguments? Do I counter those? How do I counter them? Do some of them I have to agree on because a jury wouldn't believe me if I just argued against everything? And this makes so much sense what my opponent's saying that I'd look ridiculous if I said he or she are wrong. Same thing happens in politics, in government.
That takes courage, though. That takes a lot of courage to say, maybe this person's right.
Yeah. Well, you have to think about what is your goal here. Is public service, are you there to represent people and get something accomplished, or are you there to get reelected? Sometimes forfeit getting reelected to do what's right. I like to tell people I would like to think that I was a good public servant. I was a lousy politician because I wouldn't do whatever it took to get reelected. But every night I got to go to bed and put my head on the pillow and got to go to sleep with a conscience and a satisfied heart. So again, people have to think, why am I there? Am I there to get reelected, or am I there to accomplish something for the people who sent me here to represent them?
And that's a powerful statement. And I've had this debate with folks in the past. I'm always a glass half full, always the optimist. Has something to do with my name. I just love it when everybody gets along with each other and things like that.
That's why we get along so well. I'm the angel, and you're the other guy.
There you go. But I do believe that almost everybody, maybe a very rare exception, and it's usually the folks that are on the very, very far extremes, either left or right. But generally speaking, almost everybody comes in for the right reasons. They believe in what they say and do, and hopefully, again, politics and the electoral process works properly where they're representing their constituents. I think, Dan, it's exactly as you just said, is that all of a sudden you go from that mode of representing to just trying to find a way to stick around a little bit longer. Yeah. So, Dan, this is kind of a loaded question over here, but are you optimistic?
I am. I believe in this nation. We rebound. We come back. We're resilient. And these things are ebbs and tides. We have our ups and we have our downs, but we always come through. There are great people in this nation that I'm fearful will not go into public service just because of the scrutiny and how personal it's gotten. When I was the district attorney, when people disagreed with what I did or what happened, people would protest outside of my office and I'd be asked about it. And I'd say, I fight every day for their right to assemble and free speech, even when it's against me. When I was in Congress, people came to my home. And many of those times I was in Washington and my wife and my baby were here alone. So it's gotten so incredibly personal that people, first of all, probably don't want to go to the scrutiny because you get vetted. You find out things about yourself you never knew in a political campaign. And the first thing every campaign does is does a book on their own candidate. So they find out what's in their background before your opponent points it out. But besides that, if people disagree with you, they could write letters. They could come to your Washington, D.C. office. They could come to your local office, complain, protest, march, hang out signs, call you anything that they want to call you. But when they come to your home and put vulgar things on your lawn and stuff, it kind of turned me off, too. I lost my last election in 2018. My goal was to win then. And in that spring, I was going to announce that I was not going to seek re-election in 2020 because of my little one was 3.5 at the time. And she would have been 5.5 in my next election. And she would have heard things about her father that weren't true, but that I'm sure would be upsetting to a 5.5-year-old daughter. So I was done, only because of what it was doing to my family. And I'm sure there's others who feel the same way, and I'm sure there's others who look at this who think I would love to serve in the House of Representatives. I'd love to serve as a district attorney. I'd love to serve somewhere in public life, but I don't want to put my family through that. So it's gotten to a point where that has gotten to an extreme even with the public's involvement in what's happening. I'm a fan of protest. I'm a fan of people voicing their opposition. That's how we know, is what we just talked about. I want to know what the other people, why do you think I was wrong? Tell me why. Maybe I was wrong. I think I was right when I made that decision, but maybe it was the incorrect decision. Tell me why, so I don't do it again. If in fact you convinced me that I was wrong. But the way it happens now, the destruction, when people feel that they were wronged or someone was wronged, I never was able to equate a government wrong, and the reaction to that is breaking windows in storefronts and looting. I never saw where that relationship was, other than taking advantage of a situation and taking attention away from whatever the wrong was that you're angry about. But again, I'm going to be 65 next year. Maybe I'm just an old cranky guy, but as far as Gump says, that's what I've got to say about that.
You couldn't have hit the nail more on the head, because when I left the military, I thought about seeking public office, and here in Chicago, it's rough. And when you learn about all the ridicule and all the things that they say about you, and I'm like, you know, and a friend of mine came and grabbed me and said, there's other ways to serve. There's other ways to support your fellow man and help people. And they're far, you don't have to be in the limelight. You can do great things and make an impact. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to do that. I'm going to hang out with Shalom for a while.
And again, Andrew, you're one of the people I was speaking about, a military man who would have been a great public that's interpreted. Or the ridiculous
context. I take it out of context. Yeah.
Taken out of context. You know, you vote on a budget bill that's trillions of dollars, and in there is like a dairy museum is Wisconsin, because that's important to the people in Wisconsin. And next time you run for reelection, your opponent is saying that you spent federal money on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. What's that got to do with New York, right? And so, yes, is it true? Yes, I voted for that bill that had a dairy museum in it. It was, you know, $30,000 out of like $3 trillion. But, you know, it's the deception, and it's really just not right. And it's used in politics because, again, the goal is to win. When I first decided to do this, I remember telling a great public official who I admired at the time, I want to serve. And he said, that's great, Danny. You got to get elected first.
That's so true. And the things that people say and the things people do. And now you add to that, of course, the online piece and the social media, the cancel culture piece, where you share a view, a personal view on something, and all of a sudden you have a whole mob of people canceling having a movement against you because of something that someone thought they heard or thought they saw without doing any kind of due diligence or asking questions. And it's an entire movement against, you know, the Dans and the Angels and the Shaloms of the world. I'm like, wow, how did that happen?
Well, that's the advantage of being a guy who's going to be 65 next month. I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have a Twitter account. I don't see these things. So they could be saying about these things about me. I don't even know it. And so it doesn't bother me.
Well, I mean, you've had a very, very, very respected career. And like you said, you might be the poorest man in the room, but you've got a lot to be proud of because you've helped a lot of people. And I'm sure it's people that some of, you know, I'm sure not everybody agreed with everything that you've said or done, but I know you've stepped into each of those roles focused on the service, and that's the key, and that's really the message we wanted to highlight here. So in our last few minutes together, I do want to talk about continued service. And you mentioned, obviously, right now you're in a different stage. You and I have had conversations. I know you've been able to finally. Take a sort of a step back, spend time at home a little bit more. You're involved in learning about new industries and so on. But you've continued your service in terms of involvement in supporting good causes. I know every conversation I've had with you, you're asking sincerely about, you know, my brothers and sisters in uniform. But you've been involved in, and I'm going to put it up over here, a really, really, really important organization. I know you're involved in a lot of organizations. You, probably being a member of Congress is a lot of fun because you get to meet amazing people and learn about incredible things. So talk to us about some of the nonprofits that you've continued to be involved in.
Well, I thank you for putting up Tunnels to Towers Foundation for your viewers. This is an incredible organization that was started by the Silla family. And Steven Silla was a firefighter, and on September 11th of 2001 was playing golf with his brothers in New Jersey when the first plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Steven left his brothers and hopped in his car, knew that his fellow brothers in the fire department would be going to the scene, drove as close as he could to get to the site, and got stuck on the Gowanus Expressway in Brooklyn, and with full uniform ran through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, now known as the Governor Hugh Carey Tunnel, to the World Trade Center. Stephen perished that day with 342 of his fellow firefighters. Every day, I'm not sure if I can even show this to your viewers, but I wear this every day for the 343 firefighters who died that day. And Stephen's family did a wonderful thing in the honor of their brother. They started the Tunnels to Tower Foundation. And what they do is they build homes for servicemen coming back from overseas who have lost limbs. Many of the injured survivors of war in recent time, because of the devices that are used, the IUDs, the incendiary devices, the explosive devices, they lose limbs. And what the Tunnel to Towers Foundation does at no cost to a serviceman or servicewoman is they build a home that suits the needs of that person. One of the first people that received a home was a young Staten Islander who went to Iraq with four limbs and came home with none. And they built a home for him that is adequate so he can live a normal as life as he could, because everything is convenient for him. And Frank Silla and his brothers and sisters who do this foundation have done this now for many, many years. And it's one that I support. I believe in their cause. They also take care of widows and orphans of fallen firefighters and police officers as well. And not just New Yorkers. They do this throughout the country. In fact, most of the homes they've built and mortgages that they've paid off have not happened in New York, but have happened throughout the 49 other states. So I'm a great supporter of them. I hope that your listeners and your viewers may take a look at the website. They have a great program where they ask people to donate $11 a month, which is probably two Starbucks. And how far that $11 per month will go if enough people did it. Their goal was to get 1 million people to do it. That means they would be able to receive $11 million a month. And that will go a long way for our service people and our fallen heroes in the fire and police department. So thank you for that. And I thank you for your time and my allowing me to be a part of what I believe is a great show. You have become a great friend to me, Shalom, and I'm a great admirer of you. Angel, tonight you've become a great friend.
No, you're stuck with me. You're stuck with me. There's no take backs. That's it.
I will leave you guys with what my great friend, Mayor Ed Koch of New York, who crossed party lines, Ed Koch, the Democrat, crossed party lines three times to endorse this Republican. And Ed Koch famously said to his constituents, if you agree with me 60% of the time, vote for me. If you agree with me 90% of the time, go see a psychiatrist.
Well, God bless you, brother. God bless you, brother. Thank you. Thank you for your friendship. Thank you for your continued service. This is the first of many. I look forward to having many, many more discussions with you. And you've shared a lot of, honestly, just words of truth about service. And I know I'm better for it. Angel, last word over to you.
No, just thank you, Dan. And I look forward to having a long and fruitful relationship and reaching out to you. And I'm sure we can collaborate on some things. And you know what? Anytime I need insight and figuring out why things are going awry, I'll probably reach out to you and say, what's really going on?
And I'll let you know, my brother.
I know you will.
Listen, stay safe and healthy. And to all your viewers and your listeners, please stay safe and healthy. Our country will get through this. We always do.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's a wrap for us here on We All Serve. Be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share. We'll be back next week with another conversation all about leadership, all about service. So make sure you, again, are...
And all about hair products.
And all about hair products. Right?
We got the Instagrow. I'm going to get some kimchi up here. It'll be all right.
All right. Thanks so much.